visit a website called KeoneE.org, KEONNE.org. There's two calls to action on that page. One is to sign the petition asking the president to pardon Bill and myself. That's free to do. Please, if you read the petition and agree with it, or have heard what I've said and agreed with it, please do sign it. Please share it with your friends and family. And then the second thing is there is a donate button on the website to donate to my family and Bill's family. If you feel moved to donate what you can, please do. But otherwise, what's really most important at this point is signing that petition and sharing that petition. And those two things, I think, would be the most helpful right now.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Keone Rodriguez is a co-founder of Samurai Wallet. He is now going to prison for writing privacy software that worked too well. Keone Rodriguez, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. This is, I think, a really important conversation. Sorry that for what you're going through, and that you're sort of the bearer of this information, I feel like. But I'd really like to kind of get into the backstory. What drew you to Bitcoin? How did you hear about it, and what made you feel like it was something you should be interested in?
Yeah, sure. It's an important question because it gets to the heart of everything that I did while building Samurai Wallet. So I got into Bitcoin in 2012. That's when I really got into it. But I had heard about Bitcoin probably in 2010. And it's a really nerdy and weird way that I heard about Bitcoin. I played Minecraft at that time, and I was on a Minecraft server with a bunch of libertarians and anarcho-capitalist kind of people. And one of the guys on that server was selling a stack of 64 Minecraft diamonds for one Bitcoin. And it was the first time that I had ever heard of Bitcoin and what it was, and I didn't really understand it, but that's when it first entered my conscious, right? How is this person able to sell in-game items for currency, whatever it may be? But I kind of put it on the back burner from there. And around that same time, I was about 20 years old in 2008 when the Great Recession was happening, and I was working and I was earning money, and I knew something wasn't right with the financial system, and I started to exit that system by buying gold and silver because it was a bearer instrument. There was no third party in between me and my gold and silver, and it was a censorship resistant type of money, right? The government wasn't involved in it. I could spend it if I needed to, however I wanted to. So these were already properties that were really important to me. But by 2012, I don't remember exactly how it happened, but something clicked in my brain with Bitcoin. And I started to understand that actually this digital currency that I've been hearing about for the last several years is really, or can really be, a better version of gold and silver, an electronic version of gold and silver. I really then understood that it couldn't be inflated, that the supply was fixed, that most importantly to me, that there is censorship resistance, right? Because it, just like gold and silver, it's a bearer instrument. It's mine. And if it's not mine, it means it's not in my control anymore. And no one can stop a payment or transaction from happening. So at that point, it just clicked in my brain. And I was like, okay, I need to get involved in this thing. I am into this. So I went on a mission of finding a job in the Bitcoin space, which was very young at that time. 2012 is still pretty small space. But I knew that if I wanted to get Bitcoin, and I wanted to get it, I would need to work for it, right? I wasn't, buying it wasn't as straightforward and easy as it is today. And I really didn't trust third-party exchanges. So I said, if I want to get Bitcoin, I need to earn Bitcoin. So I went out and tried to find a job. And I was successful. I did. I used my skills in product design and product development to land a job at blockchain.info. That's what it was called back then. Now it's called blockchain.com. They had the first web wallet for Bitcoin that was entirely non-custodial, meaning they didn't take your private keys. And to me, that was an essential aspect of the whole system. If you had to trust a third party, then you really weren't using Bitcoin properly. So I worked at blockchain.info. I met Bill, who I would later co-found Samurai Wallet with. He was employee number, I think, 6 or 7 at Blockchain. I was employee number 8. And Bill and I got on like a house on fire. We both had the same kind of vision about Bitcoin. We had the same goals. What was important to us was, again, censorship resistance and no third parties, no counterparty risk. I was at Blockchain from 2012 to 2015. And between 2012 and 2015, we had a huge surge of new entrants into the Bitcoin space, right? The price had gone up. It hit $1,000. It was like a big deal. Price dropped back down. You know, it was a wild time, but a lot of people were entering the space. And a lot of people who had a different value proposition to Bitcoin. To them, it was more of an investment. It was more of a financial asset that they could make a lot of money on. And to their credit, they were right. Not saying they were wrong. But their priorities were very different than mine and Bill's. We love the price going up, right? We take our salary in Bitcoin. So price goes up, that's really good for us. But that wasn't the central thing. The central thing to us was privacy, censorship resistance, and the culture was starting to shift where that was becoming less important. And we started to see a lot of regulated exchanges pushing third-party custodians. So self-custody was less important and privacy was less important. So Bill and I were talking one day while we were at Blockchain. And this is, again, in the context of what was called the scaling wars of 2015. Right, where Roger Ver made a new altcoin called Bitcoin Cash and people were leaving Bitcoin and it was a whole mess. We didn't want to do that. We didn't want to leave Bitcoin. We love Bitcoin, right? We wanted to support Bitcoin. So we didn't want to leave Bitcoin. We didn't want to join like an altcoin like Monero or something, which is a private cryptocurrency. We wanted to work on Bitcoin. So I said, we both said, let's build the software that we want to see and that we want to use. And it doesn't matter if only 10 other people want to use this software. We'll create it because we want to use it. And that software ended up being Samurai Wallet. So Samurai Wallet was first and foremost a Bitcoin wallet with two major red lines. We never wanted to take custody of user funds, and we never wanted to implement any sort of KYC or AML or, you know, data collection. Because that was antithetical to our beliefs. And we didn't think we had to because it was non-custodial. You know, it's pretty straightforward. So the point of Samurai Wallet was first and foremost, transactional privacy. How can we get more private transactions on Bitcoin without changing the underlying protocol of Bitcoin? And you do that through a Bitcoin wallet. The gateway to the entire ecosystem is a wallet. So that's what we decided to build.
What kind of service is Samurai Wallet and how does it work?
Yeah, so Samurai Wallet was a Bitcoin wallet. I mean, it's pretty simple. Most of your listeners probably have interacted with a Bitcoin wallet in some degree, hopefully one that is self-custodial or non-custodial, right? So that's what Samurai Wallet was. You downloaded a mobile application either from the Google Play Store or using a direct download link or from a third-party application store like F-Droid or something like that onto your Android phone. When you first booted it up, you had two options. One was, do you want to enable Tor, which is a network privacy tool. We were the first Bitcoin wallet to actually natively integrate Tor into the application. So before that, it was kind of difficult to set up properly. In Samurai Wallet, you just pressed the button and Tor was enabled. And then the second thing you were asked when you first installed it is, do you have your own Bitcoin node? And if so, do you want to connect to that? Some users have their own Bitcoin nodes, but many users don't. So we gave them the option to connect to their own Bitcoin node or to connect to our Bitcoin node. And if your listeners don't know, a Bitcoin node is just essentially how your wallet determines what its balances are and what the transaction history is. A Bitcoin node is essentially talking to the blockchain and seeing what the state of transactions are, coins are. And then from that point, the wallet would provide you with your seed words. I'm sure your listeners are aware. You get 12 or 24 words that you write down. And those words, when you can take them to any other wallet, right? You don't have to use Samurai Wallet. You can go to Sparrow Wallet or Edge or Blue, whatever, one of the many wallets out there, and use those same words to reconstitute your wallet, right? And get access to the same coins that you expect to have there. So it was just a simple self-custodial Bitcoin wallet. Where the complexity came in is what we were focusing on within the feature set of the wallet. And like I said earlier, that was primarily privacy enhancing technologies. So, I mean, we had so many. I don't know if you want me to get into the details of them, but generally they were, yeah. Okay. Yeah, sure. So the word Mixer and Tumblr is really not accurate, right? We use those words because everyone knows what that means. But in the context of what Samurai Wallet did and what other non-custodial CoinJoin implementations such as Wasabi and Join Market do, it's not really coin mixing. So to start, I'll explain what coin mixing is. And that is the old school, you have one Bitcoin and you send it out of your control to a mixer, and then the mixer sends back a different Bitcoin to you, right? And the goal of that is to separate the history of the old coin from the new coin. That's how mixers worked, and there's a big issue with mixers, and it's pretty simple. You have to trust the mixer. You have to send your Bitcoin to the mixer and hope that you're getting your Bitcoin back. And there's nothing that can stop the mixer from saying, actually, I'm not going to send this back. I'm going to run off now. So we never wanted to do that, right? Again, these red lines that we put in place, no custody, no KYC, etc. So by doing something like that, we would be crossing that red line into custody. Not desired. So in, I believe it was 2013, a Bitcoin core developer named Gregory Maxwell wrote onto the Bitcoin Talk forums and suggested a technology called CoinJoin. And it was, he didn't write the code, he just wrote the theory of it and how it would work and what it would do. And the idea of CoinJoin was to mimic the results of coin mixing, right? Separating the past history from the future activity of your Bitcoin without having to give up custody. So the user wouldn't be introducing counterparty risk into their risk profile. And that was in 2013. And it kind of just sat there and various people tried to work on it over the years. But it wasn't until 2019 that we finished our working implementation of CoinJoin. So we took Gregory Maxwell's theory and wrote code around it and implemented it in Samurai Wallet in a mobile application. That was a pretty big deal. And the idea of it very simply is you are one of up to 8 people who want to obscure the transaction history of your coins. So it's you and 8 other people at the same time who have the same interests and goals as you. You get together and form a transaction together. And that transaction is 8 people on this side sending to themselves on this side. But because they all look alike, you can't tell which coin belongs to which person. And again, it's the goal is the same as coin mixing, but the how it's set up is different, right? No custody leaves. You have one Bitcoin, and then you send it to yourself, and you still have that one Bitcoin, but eight other people have done that with you. Now there's doubt and confusion on the blockchain. And that's essentially what every single one of our features was designed to do, create doubt and confusion on a public blockchain.
Health insurance is broken. I know it, you know it. So when open enrollment rolls around and all those health insurance companies start hoping you'll just re-sign, eyes closed, for the same overpriced plan with confusing fine print, it feels like they're betting on your inaction. But we deserve better than that. That's why I started looking for something different for me and my family, something honest. That's when I found CrowdHealth. With CrowdHealth, it's not about profits. It's about people and community. You get a team that helps negotiate your bills, access to low-cost prescriptions and lab tests, and a list of doctors who don't treat you like a number. And if something major happens, you cover the first $500. Then the crowd steps in to help share the rest. It feels real. It feels like taking care of your health the way it should be. Simple, direct, and human. Thousands of members already say CrowdHealth saved them tens of thousands of dollars over traditional insurance. And with many subsidy programs ending and costs rising, there's never been a more important time to take charge of your healthcare. So this open enrollment, don't sign because you're told to, sign because you choose to. If you're ready to join a community that looks out for you, give CrowdHealth a try. Join CrowdHealth to get started today for $99 for your first 3 months using code MATRIX at joincrowdhealth.com. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Opt out, take your power back. This is how we win.
Wow. And I'm sure going into this, you thought about the legality and compliance and things of this nature. Where were you kind of getting your guidance from? Where does FinCEN fit in through this throughout the years?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's exactly why we felt so confident in building this technology openly. FinCEN is the regulator in charge of money transmission and illicit crime, financial crime in general. There, FinCEN stands for the Financial Crime Enforcement Network. And in 2013, so pretty early on, Bitcoin was on their radar. And they had to figure out, what is Bitcoin and like how does it tie into the crime enforcement that we perform? And they wrote guidelines that early on in 2013. And they said in 2013, in order to be a money transmitter, which is a entity that is regulated by us, by FinCEN, you have to take custody of the assets, right? So for example, Coinbase. When you buy Bitcoin on Coinbase, custody of that Bitcoin remains with Coinbase until you transfer it off their platform into a wallet you control, right? Coinbase is without question a money transmitter, according to FinCEN, because Coinbase has that custody. But a wallet, software wallet like Samurai Wallet or any other non-custodial wallets, those are just software providers, according to FinCEN guidance in 2013, because none of those softwares take and control anyone's money. So it was pretty straightforward, common sense regulation from FinCEN that essentially said, in order to transmit money, you actually have to hold the money to transmit, right? You can't transmit something you don't have. And that was pretty straightforward. So that was 2013. In 2019, they issued new guidance to build off of that. And they were even more explicit about the custody requirement. And they even talked about anonymity providers, service providers, stuff like Tumbling and Mixing. And again, they reiterate, in order to be a money service business or a money transmitting business, the service would have to take custody of the coins. So to us, that was crystal clear. The regulator in charge says, if you don't have any custody, you're not a money transmitter. Pretty clear stuff. But even with that clear guideline, we engaged with a law firm before we launched Whirlpool. We hired a lawyer, retained a lawyer as and put him on, you know, on the books as our counsel, and asked him, we read the FinCEN guidance. We think it makes sense. We understand it. But do you get the same conclusion that we do? And the answer was a resounding yes. It's very clear. It couldn't be more clear. Custody is a requirement of transmission. That, unfortunately, was not the end of the story, as one would expect it to be. On April 24th of 2024, the FBI raided my home with over like 40 to 50 armed agents and arrested me for unlicensed money transmission and conspiracy to operate an unlicensed money service business and conspiracy to commit money laundering. Two things that we didn't think were possible for a software developer who never actually had anyone's money.
Wow. Where, maybe along this journey then, did you feel your own risk level increasing? I agree with you. You know, I started my journey a lot later in Bitcoin, in 2017, the end, and a lot about number go up, but there were the block size wars in the background. It was very confusing. So you're looking at this and I think it's very prophetic in a lot of ways that you're looking at privacy and scaling, just not getting the attention it needs. I don't think there's anything that more important in Bitcoin today than privacy versus scaling, privacy, self-custody. These are the most important, running a node, and a lot of that ethos has gone away. You're getting clear guidance from FinCEN, you're getting guidance from your lawyers, but was it a complete sneak attack in April, or did you sort of feel the risk level rising with the Biden administration, maybe an Operation Chokehold?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I knew from the start, from 2015 when we started it, that governments were not going to like the software we built. That wasn't a surprise, right? We're building software that really puts the user in control and gives the user a certain level of financial privacy that the government doesn't like. The government has spent the last several decades slowly eroding basic financial privacy to the point where now most people are, if not okay with, at least accepting of the fact that the government is going to be peeking in your bank accounts and taking note of every transaction you're making above $600. That concept 30 years ago, 20 years ago, would have been outrageous, right? Now it's just, it might be outrageous, but it's like, oh, well, what are you going to do? So we were trying to give people back basic financial privacy. So of course the government wasn't going to like that. I never thought they were. But I thought that the law was clear and the regulatory guidelines were clear so that even if we did create software that the government didn't like, they really couldn't do much about it as long as we stayed on the right side of the law in terms of that custody component. So I knew they wouldn't like it, but I also had no warning they were going to respond this way. It's not like they called my lawyer up one day and said, hey, we think, you know, Keone's breaking the law. No, it was a complete sneak attack surprise and really, frankly, over the top, you know, to raid my house with, you know, the SWAT team and drones and armored vehicles and pointing guns at my wife and me. Completely unnecessary. I'm not a violent person. I don't have any criminal convictions, no history of violence. Quite frankly, all they had to do was call me or my lawyer and say, surrender yourself because we have charges against you. And I would have, you know, I'm not going to fight. I'm going to fight in the court system. I've always said that I'm not going to fight any other way. So yeah, it was a sneak attack and it was completely unnecessary and it was all theatrics. And on the Biden administration specifically, yes, I knew that the Biden administration was pretty hostile to crypto. They were open about that. But again, it just went back to the fact that I thought we understood the regulatory environment. I thought we understood what FinCEN was saying. And I understood from my lawyers that we were in the clear. So again, just stay on that right side of the law. Don't go into, you know, territory of custody and you're pretty good to go. Unfortunately, that just didn't end up being the case.
so much lack of clarity there, and it sounds like you're on solid ground. So how does the sort of things unfold from there, maybe with the trial and evidence and discovery?
Yeah, so after arrest, when I figure out what the charges are, we get to work pretty much immediately. We hire a defense team, a legal defense team, both for me and for Bill, and the discovery process begins. And in discovery, the government is required to hand over all evidence they have against you, good and bad. So good evidence for you is called exculpatory evidence. And by law, they need to give that to you. They can't hide it. That's a Supreme Court ruling. So in this case, there was an extreme amount of discovery. Terabytes on terabytes on terabytes of discovery. And a person might be thinking, oh, they had so much on you, right? Like they had terabytes of evidence against you. No, that's not what it was. For example, they subpoenaed Google for my Gmail account, right? My Gmail account has been in use since 2006, when Gmail first, or sorry, 2004, when Gmail first came out. I've had an account there. So I have a lot of emails. I did not maintain inbox zero. I had emails going back to 2004. Every single one of those emails was included in discovery, right? Because that was part of the evidence, even if it's not anything to do with the case. They collected it, so they have to give it to us. And that's a tactic that they often use to bury a defendant, right? If you have terabytes of stuff you have to go through, your lawyers have to go through it. They have to go through it in case there's something there. And a Manhattan attorney is $2,000 to $3,000 an hour. So you have a person going through this stuff for $2,000 to $3,000 an hour, you're going to run out of money, right? Because you're not the government. You don't have endless resources. So this is a common tactic to really squeeze a defendant. But that's what they did, and we dealt with it. We went through it. We used tools to try to sift through everything. And if we go through this process, is going forward now for a year. We're now a year into this process of discovery review and going over the evidence and seeing what they have versus what they really don't have. And for some reason, thank God, my attorney writes to the prosecutor and asks them very specific question. They say, hey, have you ever had a conversation with FinCEN, the regulator, about Samurai Wallet? And the government had to respond, and they did. They said, well, yes, we have had a conversation with FinCEN about Samurai Wallet. Here's the conversation. And they provided the email. So they didn't hand this over to us before. This wasn't part of the terabytes and terabytes of discovery. They forgot to give this to us. And when we read it, it was a bombshell. It was a shock, because the government, 6 months before they brought the indictment against us, went to FinCEN and asked them, is what Samurai Wallet doing illegal? And FinCEN answered them explicitly and clearly, no, they don't take custody. Therefore, we do not consider them a money service business regulated by us. Wow. 6 months later, the government brings an indictment with one of the charges being unlicensed money transmission, even though the regulator in charge of giving the license said they don't need a license. It was a shocking turn of events. And we really thought that was going to be a big bombshell to the court, right? Not only is there this exculpatory evidence, they didn't share it with us for over a year, and they're supposed to give us everything. Not only that, but they went to the regulator. The regulator said they don't need a license, and then they bring charges for not having a license. This is clear malicious prosecution.
Let's talk about the prosecution. Why were you being prosecuted in New York? Is that where Samurai has... are you domiciled in New York? Is that where you have the most business or something? Why was it in New York? Why do you have to hire a Manhattan lawyer?
Yeah, excellent question. No, Samurai was not domiciled in New York. Neither Bill or myself had been to New York to do any business. I hadn't even been to New York for pleasure purposes for well over a decade. There was no ties to New York. The way that the Southern District of New York gained what they called jurisdiction over the case is they sent an FBI agent outside to stand in central Manhattan, pull out his phone, install Samurai Wallet, make a transaction using Samurai Wallet, and that was it. Now they said, they claim, we have jurisdiction. And this is something that the Southern District of New York is famous for. The Southern District of New York thinks that they have jurisdiction over any case they want, right? Because all the wires come through Manhattan. Everything goes through Manhattan. So we're the Southern District. We can bring charges against you. So in this particular case, this is a Biden DOJ at this point. The U.S. attorney is a man called Damian Williams. And Damian Williams wants to be the sheriff of crypto. He took down Tornado Cash. He took down FTX. I mean, rightfully so on that one, but you know, that's what his goal, right? He's looked at Giuliani taking down the mafia, and he says, I want to be that guy, but for crypto. So he went after all of the crypto things that he could go after because he wants to make a name for himself. He's not going to be a U.S. attorney after Biden, right? He needs to advance his career. So it's either getting a job at a high paid white shoe law firm afterwards, where he can say, hey, I had a 98% conviction rate, or it's elected office, right? He wants to be governor, or he wants to be a congressman or something like that. So he wants to advance his career. And this is a good way to boost up his resume. That's why they went after Tornado Cash. That's why they went after us. And at least one of the reasons why they went after us. Not the only one. I'm sure that was a broad administration level strategy. We need to crack down on crypto. We're going to get the best U.S. attorney's office in the country, Southern District. They're going to go after them.
Yeah, but this isn't going after predatory finance or pre-mines or, you know, fraud or real. We'll get into what real money laundering is. But there was a change of administration. We're in the year 2025. Didn't the Trump administration and his team give direction or guidance to the DOJ? What guidance was given there? And when was that? When did that come out?
Yeah, so the Trump appointed a deputy attorney general named Todd Blanche. Todd Blanche is the deputy attorney general of the DOJ over at Main Justice in D.C. And Todd Blanche wrote a memo. I forgot exactly when it was, but it was shortly after the inauguration. Wrote a memo to all of his U.S. attorney's offices in the country and said, we're ending regulation by prosecution. He said, software developers should not be held liable for the actions of their end users. I mean, this is clear. What he was talking about were two cases, Tornado Cash and Samurai Wallet, because those are the only two cases going on where software developers who've never had custody are being targeted by a DOJ for the actions of their end users. Unfortunately, the Southern District of New York has a nickname, and that nickname is the Sovereign District of New York. They do what they want. They really could not care less what an administration says if they don't agree with it, right? They so happen to agree with the Biden administration in cracking down on crypto, but when Trump says he wants Bitcoin or crypto to be, or America to be the capital of crypto, and the DAG, Deputy Attorney General, says we're ending regulation by prosecution, they don't care. They will willfully ignore it, just like they did in this case. It's really something that President Trump needs to address in this, you know, before he leaves office, because he better believe they're going to come after him and his family next when he doesn't have the protection of the presidency.
So here you are, you're fighting for our financial freedom, but you're also fighting for your own life, and you're going through what sounds like a year or more of discovery and figuring out how to raise your defense. And what happens with the judge? Like, didn't you want to raise a bunch of motions Because I mean, it sounds like some serious stuff was discovered during pre-trial.
Yeah. So when we discovered that the government had secretly communicated with FinCEN before bringing the indictment and then hid that information from us, we wrote a motion to the court. And in that motion, we asked the judge to do two things. One, to compel the government to hand over everything they had, right, that we didn't know what to ask for. If it's exculpatory, Brady information, they have to hand it over. And two, we wanted to figure out exactly why they didn't hand it over. Who made that decision to not hand it over? So we put this into a motion. We had another motion, a motion to dismiss the indictment. And in a motion to dismiss the indictment, you, at that point of pretrial, you have to assume everything the government has said about you is true in the indictment, which, P.S., they lie a lot, but you assume everything they said is true, and you still say the indictment should be dismissed because the law does not support it, right? Even if all those facts are the case, the law isn't on their side, and here's how. And we put together a phenomenal motion to dismiss, really good. We had another motion, which was a simple thing, asking the court to allow what are called amicus briefs. These are pieces of literature written by Coin Center, by the DeFi Education Fund, by the Bitcoin Policy Institute, to inform the judge, who's not an expert in Bitcoin, not an expert in cryptocurrency, but to give her some, or him, some understanding of the different aspects at play. It's a very common thing that almost all judges like to have, right? Because it's just additional information they can read to understand something. So one might be about what's a non-custodial Bitcoin wallet versus a custodial Bitcoin wallet. You know, what is the blockchain? How does that actually work? What is a Bitcoin node? How does that actually work? Things that just, you know, may be helpful. So we had other ones, but those were the big three that we wanted the judge to consider. The judge gave a date, said, okay, on this date, you come up and we're going to argue the motions and I'll make my rulings. 2 days before that date, the judge changes. New judge, which is very unusual. Normally in a criminal trial, you have a judge assigned to you at the start and that judge sees you through all the way to the end. It happens when there's, you know, a judge gets sick maybe or something like that, but it's incredibly rare. And in our case, our original judge wasn't sick. He was still hearing cases. So we don't know why he changed. And we went from having this judge, Judge Berman, to being assigned a new judge, Judge Cote, who has a reputation as a very pro-prosecutor judge. She herself was formerly the head of the DOJ's criminal division at the Southern District of New York. These are the people who are prosecuting me. She was before a judge, she was their boss. Yeah, not great. She also has a reputation for being a very harsh sentencer. So if you go appear before her and go to trial and lose at trial, she's giving you the max sentence. Also not great. But we hadn't been in front of her yet. We didn't really know what to expect. And we did have three motions, at least three motions in front of her that we were going to argue. We get up there ready to say our piece, ready to do what we're going to do. And before we even can begin, she sits at the bench. The stenographer starts typing. And she says, I've read the motions and I'm denying all of them. No argument. No one got to get up and say our piece. Just one word from the judge, denied. And normally when a judge denies or accepts a motion, they write an opinion. And that opinion explains their thought process as to why they either accepted or denied the motion. And if they don't write it, then they give it orally. So it's either called an oral opinion or a written opinion. This judge did neither. I still to this day, no idea why she denied our motions, other than one word, denied. And even if the motion to dismiss being successful was unlikely, which it was, most judges don't do that. They just let it go to the jury either way. They still give a reason why they're denying it. They'll say because of this precedent or this law or whatever they're going to say. That was very odd. But what was really odd was the denial of amicus briefs, of additional information that the court could use to broaden their understanding of something a, you know, 79-year-old woman has no idea about, who has never really heard of Bitcoin. Why would you deny having additional information? So at that point, I think we realized that this was far from going to be far from a fair trial. We had a judge who was hostile, who didn't want to learn and didn't want to give us any indication of anything, right? So if it really did feel like this was going to be a fight that we could not win with a judge like this.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels so stubbornly unjust. I mean, new judge to the case 2 days prior and doesn't even really want to dig into the back and forth and arguments being made, evidence being supplied, opinions, guidance, all things of this nature that you would think you'd want, you know, if you're going to find truth, you'd want to shed light and shine light on all of this.
Yeah, just one thing to respond to that, because I was with you there. I thought maybe, perhaps naively, that the justice system, even imperfect, and we know that it's imperfect, but that the justice system ultimately wanted to get to truth, right? Wanted to get to justice. But that couldn't be further from the truth. The government lies so much in a criminal indictment and so much in a criminal investigation, like straight up lies, and they get away with it to the point where most people just won't believe me when I tell them this because they haven't gone through it. But if you've ask anyone who has gone through a federal criminal trial versus the DOJ, it's the same story every time, especially these white collar cases, right? It's the same story every time. Out of context statements, complete omissions of truth and fact. All of these Brady violations constantly happening. Hiding of evidence, misstating the facts to the judge. This happens constantly. So the point is, it really isn't about truth. It's about winning. And the prosecutor is supposed to be the one who's on the quest for truth. And they don't care. They really don't. And it's a very unfortunate thing, one, for me who's actually dealing with it, but two, just as an American, you want your justice system to be blind. You want your justice system to work properly, not to be focused, hyper-focused on winning, but focused on finding out what the truth is and pursuing that no matter where it takes you. And I'm very disappointed to find out that really is not the case.
When it comes to Bitcoin, the rules are simple. Run your own node, hold your own keys, and protect your seed phrase. That's where Microseed comes in. Unlike bulky backups, Microseed is stamped onto a tiny steel washer. Fireproof, waterproof, and so small you can carry it anywhere or hide it in plain sight. Go to microseed.io and use the code MATRIX for a discount on your order.
The justice system for the civilians and normal person is so fragile and so broken. You think about sort of democracy, and we could argue whether that's the end state for humanity. But here we're in a situation where appointed individuals are taking sort of the whole country's view and making decisions, right? So either not sharing evidence, good or bad, a single person, right? We don't get to find out who that is. The system's supposed to give you an impartial judge, and they get to change the judge midway through, right? In a very not really impartial district. That seems to have gone rogue. I mean, this is where Ross Ulbricht, I think, was unfairly tried. He had no real business in New York, no ties to New York.
Yeah,
I think Schumer appointed the judge there, and there was a lot of shenanigans in that trial for sure, and things hidden and things held back, and other trials going on at the same time. And this is also where Trump faced issues, President Trump personally, with, I think, mortgage fraud that didn't seem like sort of real fraud. So How fast did it unfold from you think and hope you have a fighting chance, you're making a case, to the door is going to slam really shut, she's the kind of judge that crushes people with punishment, I'm not getting a fair case. How fast did that go from there?
Pretty fast from there. I mean, at this point, when by the time that happened, we're over a year in, right? And we're fighting. We think these charges are bogus, and we're going to fight this case. And we think we have a pretty good shot, especially with the judge, the original judge, who seemed to be, he was old too. He had really no idea about Bitcoin, but he at least seemed to be willing to let us argue the case we wanted to argue. Once we got the new judge, who just really showed that in that hearing that she wasn't there to be fair, it became pretty clear we needed to make a deal. As far as I know, we didn't go to them for a deal, but they did come to us with a deal. And it would have been quite frankly crazy not to take it, because it was almost a certainty that we were going to get convicted at trial. And if we did get convicted at trial with this judge, who's known as a hanging judge, right? This is, if we still had hangings in this country, this is the judge who would be ordering them. We knew that if we lost a trial with this judge, she would convict us for 25 years. And, you know, you start doing the mental calculations, right? You start doing the arithmetic in your head. And it's like, okay, 25 years away from my family, away from my wife, because I'm going to fight in an unfair fight? I'm going to fight with my hands tied behind my back and my legs shackled together? That doesn't make any sense. So they offered the deal to drop the money laundering charge if we would plead guilty to the money transmission charge, which in itself is so laughable because that's the exact charge that Finn said, you know, said didn't apply to us. And it just shows the government doesn't care. They really don't care what the Treasury Department had to say about it, which is what FinCEN's part of. They said, we're the Department of Justice. We say it's against the law. It doesn't matter what FinCEN says. Okay. So they got their way. We made that plea. We had to forfeit the entire earnings that we ever made with Samurai Wallet over 10 years. And we had to plead guilty to unlicensed money transmission.
Let's break that down. What were they throwing at you on top of the 25 years? Let's maybe look at some of the numbers here. What were they saying about the business? What did the business do? And how did they come to some of their conclusions, albeit, you know, wrong or erroneous or unjust? But
I can't verify these numbers, so we're just going to assume the numbers that the government has said are true, though I wouldn't take it as gospel, but let's just work with what they give us. So they said that Samurai Wallet had transmitted $2.3 billion total. They called this unlawfully transmitted because in their theory, we were required to get a money transmitter's license. And if we got a money transmitter's license, we were required to perform KYC and AML on every user that used Samurai Wallet, right? Again, this is a non-custodial piece of software. So because we didn't get a money transmitter license and because we didn't perform KYC and AML on any of our customers, all $203 billion that customers, you know, sent through Samurai Wallet were considered unlawful by the United States government. Of that $2 billion, the government claimed that $287 million was the proceeds of crime, of illicit activity of some manner, right? So of the $2 billion, $287 million were the amount that was laundered, quote unquote. And then they say out of that $2 billion total, Samurai Wallet earned $6 million in fees. And that was over a period of 10 years. That $6 million in fees that we earned. So what the government said is, if you go to trial and you lose, which was very likely at this point, not only will you get 25 years, but we're going to hold you responsible for paying us back the $287 million that was illicitly used through your software. They knew we didn't have $287 million, right? They knew we never took custody of that $287 million. They didn't care. They were going to put that $287 million over our heads for the rest of our life, because until you pay that back, once you're out after 25 years, you're still under their thumb, right? You can't travel. You can't leave. They'll put a lien on your property. They'll put a lien. They'll take your income every month until they hit $287 million, which they'll never hit. I can't make that, you know? So that was pretty rough. So part of the deal was, and again, it was just them turning the screw, right? Part of the deal was, well, take the plea. You won't get any more than 5 years, right? They can't give you any more than 5 years for this plea. And instead of having to pay us $287 million that you've never had, you can just pay us the $6 million that you earned in fees over the course of 10 years, right? Even though, even by their own numbers, that $6 million was total off of the $2 billion, not the $287 million. Doesn't matter. Pay us anything that you earned over that period of time, and we'll consider your $287 million debt satisfied.
Right. And they also know the $6 million they're alleging is not even, that would be off the top. That doesn't include the fees to lawyers, being compliant.
Employees. Yeah. That wasn't profit. That was right. Just revenue. So
it's all absurd. What do they get precedent out of this?
No, they don't. So the way precedence works, legal precedence only actually gets set at the appellate level, right? So if we went to trial, we got convicted, they still wouldn't have legal precedence. Legal precedence would have occurred if we appealed and then won that appeal or lost that appeal. What gets set at the district court level is, what's the term they use? Oh, persuasive authority, right? So a district court judge is not bound by the ruling of another district court judge, but they can look at other rulings and be persuaded by them. So persuasive authority is what gets set at district court level. But because we took a plea, there was no persuasive authority set, and there was no precedent, informal or formally set. So the answer to the question is no. But as I've said many times now, after going through this process, the Department of Justice doesn't care about precedents. There was no precedents coming after a non-custodial software developer. That was a brand new innovation that they thought up in 2024 and didn't need precedents to do it. So, you know, we like to think that our common law system has, you know, this legal precedence. We submitted legal precedents in our motion to dismiss that couldn't get any higher, that came from the Supreme Court of the United States, saying that you can't be part of a conspiracy unless you're actually a part of a crime. Just knowing about a crime isn't enough, right? I mean, we couldn't have had better precedents. Didn't matter. Judge ignored it. Government ignored it. Didn't matter. So unfortunately, another reality of our justice system is that. So I understood Bitcoiners worried about the precedents that was being set by this case. So, you know, the two responses I have to that is there was no precedent set by this case, but two, precedence doesn't matter. They do what they want when they want to do it.
It's obvious they do what they want. They don't need precedence. They'll go after and take down whoever they want for whatever they can want to fabricate for. But I feel like this does set precedence. This is threatening. You're going to prison in 10 days. I think we're going to hopefully make enough noise and get you to not go. And I'm very optimistic. But this is all precedence to me, and scary to, I think, already coders and developers around the world. And this is sort of the antithesis of, you know, America being the capital of Bitcoin. This is sort of me for the, this would be the end of America being a great place for Bitcoiners. The beginning of the end.
And absolutely agree.
You know, Bitcoin's code, it goes on, but I got to live somewhere. You got to live somewhere, right? And does this mean the government, the U.S. government, wants to destroy Bitcoin?
No, I don't think they want to destroy Bitcoin. I think they want to capture Bitcoin. And tools like what I built with Samurai Wallet throws a wrench in their ability to successfully capture Bitcoin in the way that they want. They want to be able to see every transaction you make. And with Bitcoin, they can. It's actually pretty great for them, right? Unless you're doing something specific to control for that, the blockchain is public. And not only is it public, it's immutable. So if they can't read it today, they might be able to read it in 10 years from now and say, oh, 10 years ago, you did something we don't like. So no, they don't want to destroy Bitcoin. They want to capture it and control it. And any software, any tool that throws a wrench into their ability to do that effectively, they're going to come down on. So that's why they came down on Samurai, and they'll come down on, you know, the next tool that they can, that gets into their scope. If people use it, if there's a mass around it, they'll come after it.
You know, a lot of people think of Bitcoin as a tool for freedom, freedom money. Can Bitcoin become a surveillance panopticon?
Absolutely. It's quite likely. So Bitcoin can be freedom money. That's why I was attracted to it. That's why I got involved in Bitcoin in 2012, because I saw its potential as freedom money. But that's not a given. It's not some miraculous divine intervention that Bitcoin is given to us in its perfect state. We need to work for that. People need to develop the tools to make it freedom money. People need, and you can't have freedom money without privacy. Privacy is essential to that concept of freedom money. So if you don't have the tools and the builders building the tools to enhance user privacy on Bitcoin, it will become a surveillance panopticon. And in some ways, it already is.
Who do you think is maybe next in line in the government's war on financial privacy?
I think it really depends. It depends on what tools emerge and the operational security of the builders, right? Hopefully, the builders learn from us that even though the law says one thing, that can still come after you and destroy your life. So we better stay completely anonymous and, you know, do all of that. If a tool becomes very successful and popular, they'll go after that tool. But I think it would be easier to target the miners in the United States, right? And they can say to these miners in the United States, hey, you're money transmitters now. You're actually the ones that are including transactions into a block that get broadcast to the network. Transactions, in fact, don't actually exist until you put them in a block. Therefore, we have a pretty good case against you as a money transmitter. You better get licensed, and you better only accept transactions from whitelisted exchanges, and you better do OFAC screening. So I think they're going to squeeze the miners eventually. And that's just another step in the wrong direction and another step in making America the backwater of crypto, right? Because miners will leave. They won't do that. They'll go offshore and they'll go to a jurisdiction where they don't have to deal with that.
Can you maybe restate the case for financial privacy, why it's so important?
It's the financial privacy is the basic building block of civilization, right? You need, not just financial, but all privacy. You need privacy to feel safe enough to say certain things that might not be accepted by the majority, right? So for example, one of our founding documents, not necessarily founding documents, but an important document in our founding was Common Sense by Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense and incited the colonial nation to take up arms against the crown. Thomas Paine wrote that under a pseudonym. It was too dangerous to write that publicly. And that was one of the most consequential publications in the world. So privacy is absolutely essential. We take it for granted, right? We all put our letters in envelopes. We all close the blinds on our door, our windows at night. We all, you know, have doors. We don't live in glass houses. We have secrets. We're humans. Privacy is absolutely essential to that. And it's been the de facto condition since the dawn of time. It's only within the last several decades that financial privacy and privacy in general have been under severe attack from governments As technology grows and they grow with technology, they're able to undermine privacy. As world events like 9/11 and other, you know, major things happen, they're able to erode financial privacy under the guise of protecting against terrorism and, you know, stopping drug cartels and this and that. So it's a pretty modern innovation that your privacy is at the whim of the government. The government is what grants you your privacy. No, that's never how it's been. That's absolutely never how it's been. And we need to build tools to combat the surveillance capabilities that the government and corporations, for that matter, employ. And that's, again, what we were trying to do with Samurai Wallet.
Wow. When was the last time you got to talk to Bill?
The last time I got to speak with Bill was at our change of plea hearing in July. I'm not allowed to speak with Bill by myself. I have to only speak with Bill when lawyers are present. So, and again, we're talking Manhattan attorneys, $2,000 to $3,000 an hour. That's $4,000 to $6,000 for a conversation with Bill. So we're not doing many of those, right? It sucks. Bill is one of my best friends, known him over a decade, and have spoken to him every single day, hours a day, prior to this all happening. I wish I could speak to Bill. And I'm hopeful that at least I'll be able to write him when I'm in prison. I don't know if that's allowed or not. I think I have to get permission from the case manager to do that. But I'm hoping that they'll give us that permission, because I'd like to talk to him, you know, just as a friend.
Wow. I can't imagine how hard this is. What are these days like as you prepare?
I'm holding up fine. You know, I've come to terms with everything, you know, that has happened. You know, it's not fair or just, but I'm not the type of person to you know, go on about that. You know, a lot of life isn't fair. And especially when you're dealing with the state or governments, a lot of things aren't fair or just. You just have to kind of deal with it. So that's where I'm at with it in my head. And these last 9 days that I have is primarily getting everything ready logistically to ease the burden and transition on my wife. Right, I don't want her to suffer unduly. There's a lot of things that I take care of that she's going to have to take care of now, because I won't be here to do it. So I'm trying to prepare her for those logistical tasks, you know, and obviously spending as much time as I can with her and my family. That's pretty much all I can do at this
point. Can you leave the house?
I can leave the house now, yes. We didn't really get into the whole bail conditions things, but just suffice it to say that at first I wasn't allowed to leave the house. And after, I think it was about the year mark, we got it so that I could get onto a curfew where I could leave the house between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. So I can do that now, which has made the bail, the house arrest a lot more bearable. You know, I'm able to go out with my wife to the park or go for a walk or, you know, normal go shopping, just normal things, which I wasn't able to do for a long time.
Yeah. Well, the case for a pardon is obvious. What can people do to help spread the word, and what can they do to contribute?
Yeah, so if they could visit a website called billandkeone.org, KEONNE.org, there's two things that, two calls to action on that page. One is to sign the petition asking the president to pardon Bill and myself. That's free to do. Please, if you read the petition and agree with it, or have heard what I've said and agreed with it, please do sign it. Please share it with your friends and family. And then the second thing is there is a donate button on the website to donate to my family and Bill's family. So half of what you donate will go to my wife, Lauren, and half will go to Bill's wife, Sabrina. If you feel moved to donate what you can, please do. But otherwise, what's really most important at this point is signing that petition and sharing that petition. And those two things, I think, would be the most helpful right now.
Going to prison all for writing Bitcoin code. This is so wrong. Please help. The hashtag is Pardon Samurai. It's a movement. Even Ross Ulbricht
popped up to show support. What was it like speaking with Roth?
That was very surprising. I was not expecting that at all. As far as I know, Ross hasn't spoken a space before. He did one appearance at a Bitcoin conference shortly after he was released, and that was kind of the last we heard from Ross, understandably so. I had been in conversations with his mother, Lynn, who had just been very supportive of me and Bill and just trying to give us encouragement, right? She's kind of gone through this. She knows the system and how it works. But I never expected Ross to jump on that space and talk with him. And it was just a beautiful moment. We had like five or 10 minutes where it felt like it was a one-on-one conversation between Ross and me. And it was very nice. Wow. Yeah. I really appreciated that.
I'm grateful that you spending this time with us. I can't imagine what this is like going through. You're a true freedom fighter. I hope this gets to Trump and his team, President Trump, and I hope they hear the message loud and clear. This needs to happen ASAP. We're in touch privately. We're in some group chats together. Anything I could do to help, you know, and I really encourage listeners to do everything they can to get the word out and contribute. So I'll leave it to you for any parting words.
I think I said it all. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to come onto your platform, tell my story to your listeners. And I hope that while I'm gone, if I do have to go and we were not successful in getting the pardon, I truly hope that the ethos of Bitcoin as freedom money doesn't go away. I hope that the ethos as Bitcoin as a censorship resistant form of cash doesn't go away, and people still fight for that vision, because that's what brought me to Bitcoin originally. The promise of that is still there, even if it's been drowned out, you know, by a different group or a louder group or the, you know, more financial or more sophisticated group. It doesn't matter. That potential is still there. So I hope the builders don't shy away and they do build the tools that we desperately need and learn from, you know, what we went through to protect themselves better. So I think that's really all I have to say. So thanks again, Cedric, for having me on.
Thank you, Keone, for all your work. And thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.